position of probably one of the poster child examples of self-dealing and looting of a corporation. The court is well familiar with the background here. I recall that Judge Adams dismissed the case in 2003 on demand futility. Justice Hardesty, in an unanimous opinion in 2006, clarified the law that should be applied in circumstances of this case. The case then went back down to Judge Adams. Judge Adams, although finding that we had satisfied demand futility, dismissed the case on two other grounds that we think are clear errors of law, and I want to briefly address those. First off, with regard to the fact that in 1995, an unrelated case was settled in Arizona. The defendants never argued until very recently that the release in that case could possibly have had any effect on this litigation going forward. Nonetheless, almost a year after we had oral argument on the motion to dismiss, Judge Adams issued a 1.5-page opinion finding that the release in the Goldwasser case barred the claims in this case. We think that's clear error of law, and the only way that Judge Adams was able to get and jump over that insurmountable hurdle was to rewrite the release by inserting language that the parties never bargained for. That is, he inserted the words other claim to try to make some sense out of his dismissal. He clearly violated what's been established law in this state for decades, that the party's intention at settlement should be respected, that the clear language of settlement agreement should be respected, and there is nothing other than a plain reading of the settlement that demonstrates that it can only relate to the Goldwasser plaintiffs in that case. It can't expand beyond that. And we have detailed that in our opening brief and in our reply brief. And I think that there can be nothing other than clear error with regard to that ruling. The second point that we think the judge clearly made error on is the dismissal of the SAC entities. The court will recall that what happened in this case is that the Schoen family, that is Mark, Joe, and James, set up an entity that allowed them to siphon off the best assets of AmeriCo into a separately held corporation. This is not a third party like a Pricewaterhouse or some auditor. This is an entity that was owned and controlled by the Schoens. And without ever actually getting the board approval throughout this process, for a period of many years, these assets were sold off and set up in the SAC entity. Nonetheless, the Judge Adams, applying the doctrine of in pari delicto, ignoring the tenets and rule cautions of this court, that just using the nomenclature of in pari delicto should be used with great caution, nonetheless, failed to apply the four tenets of the Shimack case, and in doing so, we think created clear violations, clear error of law. Obviously, the four factors, and I can tick through them quickly. The transactions at issue at the time of this case were behind us. They had already occurred. So therefore, that's one reason in pari delicto shouldn't apply. AmeriCo is the victim. There's no moral turpitude that's attributable to AmeriCo. It was AmeriCo that lost these assets. So to say that it was somehow guilty of moral turpitude would not apply. Three, the SAC entity, again, controlled and wholly operated by the Schoens, not an independent third party, is clearly the party of the greatest guilt. And fourth, the defendants would be unjustly enriched if in pari delicto were actually applied to this case. So we think on that basis alone, it would be clear error for this ruling to stand, and that we think that the cases that have looked at this, in particular Judge Pro's decision from the district court looking at Nevada law in the USACM case, which I know Justice Pickering had some familiarity with, clearly said we're going to look at the factors, the Shimack factors, and making careful application of in pari delicto, where in that case, just like this case, there were innocent shareholders who would be hurt. If we apply in pari delicto, we're not going to do it. Judge Adams' reliance on the mediator's case out of New York is clearly distinguishable. The judge made her apply in the Mediators case. Mediators was an example of a company that was wholly owned by one person, and he treated that company as if it was his own and basically transferred his art collection to himself to deprive creditors in a bankruptcy proceeding. So we think that the case law is abundantly clear that impera delicto never should have been applied. So you can't release these claims under Goldwasser, and you can't dismiss SAC by application of impera delicto. Aramerico is the victim and certainly not a co-conspirator. They cite a couple of cases like the AIG cases, totally different. AIG, in that case, there were price-fixing allegations by AIG and the other brokerage houses, Marsh and Ace. And in that case, the court said, well, in between people who are equal wrongdoers, we're not going to apportion. But here, there is no doubt that the SAC entity is not an independent third party, owned and controlled by the people who looted the company. And in those circumstances, particularly at the pleading stage where we are 8 years later, the impera delicto should not have been applied.
And if the court decided to reach that question or felt it did apply, could you comment on the adverse interest exception and whether there has been a demonstration of total abandonment?
Well, I think the answer is yes, we believe there has been a demonstration of total abandonment. The pleadings in this case and the complaint at record pages 327 through 385, I would recommend a reread, because certainly what's pled there can't be anything other than a total abandonment. The properties, the prime properties, were the product of Americo, and they were transferred out of Americo by the people who were supposed to protect the interest of Americo. And instead, in derogation of their duties of loyalty and their fiduciary obligations, they did and undertook those transactions. So,
I guess just to add, what I find interesting about the issue is this. To defend the position against total abandonment, we set up the business transactions themselves as being fair or arm's length or appropriate to say we didn't abandon. I haven't seen that really in the various cases that I read on this issue, but this would be an issue of first impression, at least for me.
Well, I think in that narrow area, it certainly could be. I mean, look, you don't have this kind of conduct occurring very often in public companies. That's one reason that there aren't a lot of reported cases on it. And certainly to the extent that the adverse interest issue is an open and debatable question, some of those cases are percolating their way up right now through New York into the Court of Appeals. But I think the clear issue before this court is there is just so much under Schimack that gets us beyond impera delicto that we really don't even have to reach adverse interest. But if we did, it clearly, we think, under these facts, would apply in the circumstance. I just want to briefly touch, but I do
before
want to say...
Before you leave that, there is no allegation, though, in the complaint of an innocent decision maker, which was the real turning point in the case I'm familiar with. Is that correct?
That is correct. And with regard to that, I think we look at maybe the CBI case out of New York, where the Second Circuit said, well, gee, innocent shareholders should be a factor in this. But you are correct that USACM was talking really about, well, who would have stopped this transaction among the people on the inside? But certainly innocent shareholders should be considered. My colleagues have raised many issues in opposition. I'm going to reserve, if I can, my few minutes that I have left to come back and try to respond as best I can.
All right. Thank you.
Your Honors, may it please the Court. My name is Jack London. I represent Americo. Americo's Board of Directors and Corporate Governance Committee are here. I would propose, Your Honors, to address the issue of the Goldwasser release and judgment and then to defer to Mr. Brandon on the issue of the SAC releases. I would, the Court will permit me, like to then resume and argue our alternate ground for affirmance, which is the demand requirement. if that's acceptable.
That's fine.
What's at issue here is corporate governance. Who controls the claims that belong to a corporation? Derivative litigation exists only to serve the corporate interest, not to continue a battle among brothers for who controls the corporation. That's not a corporate interest. Derivative litigation is an exception to the rule that corporate market democracy governs. The board of directors is held accountable, elected by the shareholders. Their decisions can be challenged or ratified in corporate elections, as has happened here. Shareholders brought the question of the SAC transactions to a vote, and although it is not dispositive of the issues before us, 72% of the issued and outstanding shares voted to ratify. Those are the mechanisms that control the claims of a corporation, except for the extraordinary circumstance where derivative litigation is appropriate. Here, the corporate governance questions are first, what is the effect of a corporation's release on subsequent derivative claims? And second, in a more general importance, how to apply this court's standards in Schoen against SAC to the question of whether a disinterested majority exists with respect to the question of whether a demand would be handled by a majority of the board who are disinterested. Addressing the first question of the release, in the Goldwasser case, there were two releases and two judgments, one on derivative and direct claims brought by one group of shareholders and only one group of shareholders, and also a release and judgment of claims directly by AmeriCo. AmeriCo, represented by counsel, appeared in the case because the plaintiffs had said they intended to pursue a challenge to the SAC transactions. And on those claims, which were presented to the court in Exhibit 2 to the settlement agreement, AmeriCo released its claims. That release has independent legal effect in addition to the effect of the release of the derivative claims of the Goldwassers only.
Counsel, if I can stop you right there.
Sure.
There's, in what we receive, there seems to be some, I won't say confusion, but seems to be an issue as to whether everyone received notice, that was supposed to receive notice of this release, and then secondly, whether or not the release extended to claims, so to speak, not in being, and as to some entities that hadn't even been created at the time of this release. What's your take on that?
The notice issue is a requirement when the release that is supposed to be enforced is a release of the shareholders on a derivative basis. The corporation can dismiss its claims without any requirement of notice. That's the Wolf case, Judge Friendly in the Second Circuit. The corporation's release does not depend on notice. But second, the rule is such notice as the court may require. Judge Silver approved the settlement and approved no notice being given. The cases cited for the notice proposition are cases where the court did not approve and no notice, and it was the derivative case release and not the corporation's release that was being relied on subsequently. So the notice issue is a red herring, we think. On the scope of the release says that the released claims include the matters discussed in Exhibit 2. The matters discussed within Exhibit 2 lay out that the subsidiary corporation, not AmeriCo, but a subsidiary, transferred real property and storage businesses to SAC corporations for a value.
SAC corporations or the SAC corporation at the time?
SAC 1 and SAC 2. For a value above cost in a transaction that was linked to a management contract that paid 6% management fees on top of costs to the subsidiary. We've heard adjectives and legal conclusions that the subsidiary gave up a valuable corporate interest, gave up these properties, had a right to, gave up its participation. The in the storage business. The adjectives and legal conclusions must be disregarded for purposes of considering the standing of the plaintiffs on the derivative claim. And for the particularized facts, over the course of a series of transactions, the sale price was an aggregate of $270 million higher than the cost. That's a $270 million gain. And the management fees brought in a net total of $111 million. That is a series of transactions that were conducted under the same structure that's disclosed in SAC, as to SAC 1 and 2, and on a basis and in a settlement that clearly was intended to address a continuing series of future transactions. As to the future scope of the release, the critical language is how the release was described in the findings of the court.
Did that specifically, my question was, does that release pertain to entities who were not in being at the time?
Your Honor, we think it does because it clearly was to address a series of transactions, and it said claims that may arise hereafter. The Hatch case says that's paragraph 5 of the judgment, agreed to by all parties in Roman numeral 5, part C of the settlement. Claims that may arise hereafter. If it's not a violation, if it is a released claim to sell property to the SAC entities for a gain above cost linked to a way of continuing to participate in the storage business for 6% guaranteed of revenue on top of costs rather than another way of participating, that business judgment, that business decision by the subsidiary corporation. If those are released, then there is no claim here. The SAC transaction, the Goldwasser release, incorporates those matters disclosed. It says claims that arise that exist now exist, hereafter exist, or heretofore have existed. That's the temporal scope of the release. It is the AmeriCo release that we are attempting to enforce, not the release of derivative claims by a shareholder. And the interpretation that says the only thing that was released were the derivative claims of the Goldwassers alone amounts to saying that AmeriCo's participation is a nullity. If only the derivative claims by these shareholders are included, that means that even as to the past transactions to the same defendants, another derivative shareholder could come along and assert those claims, which means that that would give legal effect to this judgment the same as if AmeriCo had not participated at all. Now, that can't be the correct reading of this language. There are two provisions that refer to the derivative claims of these plaintiffs only, and that's right. But that doesn't preclude the fundamental legal effect of the corporation's release. It means that that the only shareholders who were giving up their claims, individual or derivative, were the Goldwassers. But nothing about either of those provisions cuts back on the legal effect of a release that's made on behalf of a corporation, as the Wolf case and as is fundamental to why these claims are derivative implies. When the corporation gives up the claims, they're gone. Now, Your Honor, at this point, I would yield on the question of the claims against the SACs, and then I'd resume with a discussion of the demand requirement if it's permitted.
All right, you've got a little bit under 5-6 minutes.
I understand, Your Honor.
Remaining.
May it please this honorable court, my name is George Brandon, and I represent Mark Schoen and the SAC entities in this litigation. As the trial court found, the shareholders may not maintain a derivative claim on behalf of AmeriCo against the SAC entities, third parties, and the other side of the transactions that Mr. London just described. Obviously, the public policy of the state requires that there be no accounting among wrongdoers if there were wrongdoing here. And the adverse interest exception plainly does not apply. Justice Hardesty made reference to the total abandonment standard, and it would be very difficult to believe that total abandonment occurred here when, as Mr. Nolan just pointed out, the company received in excess of $600 million in cash to concentrate on its core business and have since that time received, in addition, another $111 million in management fees. The other reason the adverse interest exception doesn't apply, and hence the two in question are in pari delicto, is the the sole actor control group exception to the exception. And it seems plain here that on the basis of the allegations of the complaint, the directors and officers of AmeriCo who effected these transactions dominated and controlled the company for purposes of this, and hence their actions are imputed to the company in any derivative claim. Indeed, I think there's been a judicial admission to that effect with by the other side in the context of the demand futility argument. So in our view, that the adverse interest exception isn't even relevant in this case. And let me just touch briefly on the Shimrack factors, because those were mentioned. Obviously, this court's decision, Shimrack, is well known to it, and it was not in the context of a corporate circumstance. But I think the factor that is of most interest in this context is the third. And I believe I heard the other side say that the SAC entities are the one guilty of the greatest moral fault. It seems unlikely on these facts where the transaction, if undertaken by directors and officers of AmeriCo, would be a breach of fiduciary duty, and there'd be no breach in a third-party entity in participating in such transactions. So we don't think that the Shimrack case makes any difference in this context to the argument. With that, unless there are questions on the impari delicto, I defer back to Mr. London.
All right. Any questions, colleagues? Thank you.
Thank you.
Your Honor, the Shonigan Sack case established fundamental law for Nevada about derivative litigation, and it established that the mere allegation of participation in the transactions, that was Johnson against Steele, is not sufficient to call into question the independence of the members of the board. What's alleged, what's at stake here is who controls the corporation's claims, who's able to put to rest a cloud on the assets of the corporations. In this case, involves a request for relief of rescinding the whole series of transactions. And that is an essential matter of corporate decision-making that belongs to the board of directors to decide. It can only be taken away from them if on the pleading, the standing of the defendant is demonstrated by particularized facts raising a question about the independence of the board. This court's been very clear about what the standard for that is in the Schoen case. The court declined to apply that standard, and on remand, there's no question that Judge Adams on this point made an error. Neither side is saying that he was right in saying that all of the members of the board were interested in the SAC transactions. That's not the argument that is brought by the appellants here. Instead, they say that all of the board members face a substantial likelihood of liability, which cannot be so. They ignore the cases on the Nevada statute and articles of incorporation creating a safe harbor for conduct by members of the board of directors. They do not establish anything more than participation, which under Johnson's not enough. They argue that all of the directors signed the financial statements. Well, under the SEC, they always have to sign the financial statements. Under Nevada law, NRS 78-138-2B, they are entitled to rely on financial statements signed by CPAs. What happens here is that the CPAs changed their opinion and restated because they changed their opinion. Afterwards, those CPAs paid AmeriCo $50 million for doing that wrongfully. But the directors were entitled to rely on that. So there is no basis for saying anyone faces a substantial likelihood of liability on these claims. They don't challenge, appellants do not challenge three of the eight directors. Mr. Lyons has never been challenged. On appeal, they do not argue that Mr. Brogan or Mr. Grogan has a disqualifying interest. There are three other directors. If two of them are not disqualified, then the demand requirement applies and the case must be dismissed for lack of standing. Mr. Bayer is challenged only based on participation and signing the statements. That is not a valid basis. Mr. Dodds is challenged based on participation, Johnson against Steele, it's no longer the standard. signing financial statements, and a transaction and events in 1988 when Mr. Dodds, as a member of the board of directors, sided with the management group against the insurgent group. He borrowed to buy stock and was on that side of the transaction. Now, if that were disqualifying, so would Mr. Paul Schoen be disqualified because he was on the same side. Your Honor, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
All right. Any questions?
I have a question. Could you articulate for me your position with respect to Joe and James Schoen and the allegations with respect to the sufficiency of the allegations with respect to their alleged interest in this, i.e., you attack it as, and I don't know if it was your brief or someone else's, that it was a conclusory allegation that their transfer of interest to Mark of their interest in the SAC transactions was sort of a sham. It was for $10,000, and that that was not a legitimate transaction. They didn't truly divest themselves of that interest. Are you advocating that we adopt Twombly and say that's insufficient given all of the rest of the examination that has been put on the disinterested nature of this board by the bankruptcy court and the Arizona District Court?
That would be correct, Your Honor, although Joe and Jim are brothers of Mark, and based on the familial exception, they could be considered interested based on a familial relationship. The characterization of a sham transfer in 1994 is exactly the kind of conclusory adjective that must be disregarded for deciding financial interest. So, yes, we concede interest because of a close familial relationship. No, we do not concede a financial interest in the transaction.
Thank you.
Not adequately alleged with particular facts. There is a disinterested majority, Your Honor, and so standing is lacking.
Thank you.
The transaction, as alleged in the complaint, was a payment of $100, not $10,000. So we think that by any standard it's sham. These arguments perhaps would be persuasive, although we would still quibble on a motion for summary judgment. We're at the pleading stage. So to argue whether the transaction was good or bad ignores the standard that we have before us today, which is to look at the pleadings and to give every inference in our favor. The overwhelming inference that can be drawn from this 50-page complaint is corporate looting and total abandonment. At this stage, Judge Adams certainly made clear error in dismissing the complaint. The release, I just would implore a quick examination of the language, but the definition of released claims, and this is at the appendix, it's in the stipulation of settlement, which is 6A12D, says, does not include any claim either individual or derivatively of any AmeriCo shareholder other than the plaintiffs. And AmeriCo, in its own brief that it filed in this court, recognized, as this court did in Justice Hardesty's opinion in 2006, that a shareholder derivative claim is a claim by the shareholder that can be brought derivatively. So the clear intention, and why you had no notice in this case, Justice Douglas, is because clearly the parties didn't intend to bind everybody. These are very sophisticated lawyers who are paid a lot of money to do the right thing for their clients. And if they wanted to expand this settlement to bar everybody down the road, the easiest thing to do would have been to send out Rule 23-1 notice. That rule has been on the books for years. It's well known to everybody. So clearly you can just look at that as evidence alone of why nobody except the Goldwasser plaintiffs would be bound. And beyond that, obviously...
Counsel, you heard the statement by the other side indicating that the judge had approved that, so to speak, lack of notice. How do you respond?
I'm not sure that there's actually a finding in the record that the court has actually considered the requirements of Rule 23.1. The record that we are aware of is that the settlement agreement was signed on October 27th of 1995, and the settlement and the dismissal and final order were signed a week later. In a typical process where there is a notice, that's typically a 6 to 8 or 10 week process in my experience. So There certainly wasn't any litigation in that case. There was no record for the court to consider. And it's clear in the context of that case, context of the language, that the release was just intended to bind the gold washers from coming back. Of course, that litigation really had nothing to do with this case, and that's well settled. With regard to
Manico, in the interest of time, I wonder if you could address the particularized findings that we required in the Schoen decision to address demand futility concerning directors Bayer, Carty, and Dodds.
Yes. Carty.
Other than their signing annual financial statements.
Thank you. Clearly, Carty, the uncle of Joe and James, who effectively was the surrogate father, has three children employed at the company, we think could not possibly satisfy independence. So the familial contacts that the court found were clear with regard to Joe and James, we would say would apply with equal force with regard to Uncle Carty. With regard to Dodds, we think he's one of the, as pled in the complaint, he's one of the five golden employees. There was a veiled reference to the fight and the proxy contest and the shares, but if you look at the facts as pled, Dodd was given stock in the company, was provided with a multi-million dollar loan to buy more stock, and has clearly demonstrated he's totally beholden to Joe Schoen. Again, no independence as to him. With regard to Bayer, it's the same issue. It's that he was wholly connected with the control group of this company, and therefore there's no independence as to him. Again, I would just say, and I would look at paragraph 61 through 128, where it's laid out in great detail. With that, so that's the independence portion. So it's either we can show interestedness or independence. If we go to interestedness, we say that each of the acts that was done was not merely some signatory just stamping a document. These were willful acts by Dodds, Bayer, and Carty in the context of transferring hundreds of these assets out of America, committing the company to unsecured, to loans, non-recourse loans, and basically being part and parcel, allowing AMREC employees to be used willy-nilly by SAC without any reimbursement, any compensation. So again, I would say that all of that is laid out in the pleadings. Finally, if I could just make a final point. We're at the pleading stage. These are great summary judgment arguments. It's been 8 years. We think that this case should be reversed, and we also think perhaps it's time for a new judge to take a fresh look at this. And we would respectfully say that it would be time for reassignment. If there are any questions, I'm happy to respond.
All right, colleagues, any questions?
Just one final one.
Okay.
Because of the other two issues that arose in the dismissal, the trial judge has not yet conducted the evidentiary hearing required on the demand futility dismissal, which would be necessary if this court affirmed that determination.
Yes, and that was certainly part of your ruling in 2006.
All right. Counsel, thanks very much for your arguments today and your briefing on the matter, and will stand submitted. The case will stand in recess until the next call of the court.